Poland podcast. I'm now in New York, at the Peninsula of New York, and having great pleasure speaking to my old friend David Barbosa, who is a very established journalist, and I will let David to give a brief about himself.
Sure, Pearl. I am a longtime New York Times foreign correspondent. Spent 12 years in China. That's when I got to know Pearl. And in the last 4 years, I have been working on a startup called The Wire Digital. We are a news and data platform.
Which I have subscribed.
Yes, thank you, thank you. So I've gone from the big world of journalism to starting my own little news and data company.
I mean, I always wanted to ask you, why are you so interested in China?
You know, China, I think the first time, other than my interest in Bruce Lee when I was young, I should say, like,
oh,
that
do you
was
learn
my
Kung Fu or not?
You know, the I don't think I've told you this story, Pearl, but when I was young, when I was 8, my mother died, and my father had to tell me about this death, and he said, I want you to go to the movies. And there was a Bruce Lee film.
Enter the Dragon.
And so I went to see Enter the Dragon, and instantly I was interested in Kung Fu, not in China, but in Kung Fu. And later in college, I took a course in the journalism school called Reporting the Revolutions, China in Vietnam. The course was all about how did journalists cover the Chinese Revolution in the 30s and 40s, 49, and the Vietnam War with the United States. That got me very interested in China, the history, I went back to the library and I got all of the old microfilm of the New York Times articles that appeared in the 30s, the 40s, and during the Vietnam War, the 60s and 70s, printed them out and said, I would like someday to be a correspondent in Asia, to go to China or Vietnam, and to cover the countries as a New York Times reporter. Never thinking it would really happen.
No, because all I know that you were saying to me is you were telling me years ago that your dream was to work for New York Times.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Then when you start working with New York Times, it was like dream come true.
Yes. So first the dream was, could I get to the New York Times? And then could I ever get to China or as a foreign correspondent? But despite taking that course in college and joining the New York Times, I had one trip to China and it was canceled at the last moment. So I never went until the Times said, would you like to go to the Shanghai Bureau? I was covering Enron. Do you remember the Enron case?
Yes.
This was 2002, 2003. And I spent a year writing about Enron in Houston, a whole year covering one company. And as a reward for that year living in a hotel in Houston, the Times said, where would you like to go if you become a foreign correspondent? And we will pay for you to travel anywhere in the world to look at another country to see if that's where you'd like to go. So I said, I'd like to take my vacation in China. I'd like to go to Shanghai. I'd never been there. I want to see it. And I want to see, could I become a correspondent in China? So I took the vacation. I think I went on December 23rd or 24th of 2002. I had just met Lynn, my soon-to-be girlfriend. I took that trip to Shanghai, and within 3 days, I was saying, I called back to the New York Times and said, I am moving to China, whether you send me or not.
Oh, wow.
I love it.
So, you don't have any regret, right? Even, you know, how you escaped from China?
No. Regret? Like, I am so grateful. Like, all the people I met in China, including you, all the friends I made, all the stories I wrote, to see the one of the most interesting countries in the world at a time when, like, this was the golden age.
Yeah,
like,
it was a golden
people
age.
People didn't know in 2004, maybe many people didn't know, but 2004 to the Olympics, to I got to cover not just business. I was sent as a business reporter.
I know. You were covering Olympics as well as covering culture.
Culture, art, sports, science, any topic I wanted, I could really pitch that story to the New York Times because they didn't have correspondence in all these areas. So this was like a dream come true. In fact, as you know, I didn't want to leave China.
No, of course I know. So, I mean, I think the audience does not know that. Can you briefly, you know, I know the both stories about China.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just quickly, share
so
with...
we'll go back to 2011. That's when I worked on the stories. They were published in 2012. The first was a series we were working on Apple. I love my Apple products.
I know
you love your Apple products. But we were told the series was out of New York and we're going to look at Apple's manufacturing in China. You know, why is it manufacturing in China? What is it like in China? What are their factories like? So part of my job was to look at the manufacturing, the labor situation in China. So I was sent out to meet some of the workers at the Apple factories. And as much as I love my Apple products then and now, it was a pretty shocking story to see some of the labor conditions at Apple's partners, because Apple actually doesn't manufacture, but they outsource to companies like Foxconn. So I was visiting Foxconn facilities. I was actually, one of our stories was keyed on some of the workers who were injured, one worker who died. And so that first Pulitzer was a look at, why does Apple manufacture in China? Could it move those jobs to the U.S.? Why doesn't it? What is it about China?
And they're starting with India now.
Yes. Now they're thinking of, is China the right place for them to be? But at that time, Apple was mostly producing in Shenzhen, was about to move to Hunan with the biggest factory in the world, 350,000 workers. So this was an amazing story to see. How are your products made? What is it like at Apple? What are the labor conditions? I dealt with Apple. I dealt with Foxconn. And I think it was maybe an 8 or 10 part series looking at Apple and working conditions and manufacturing. That was the first Pulitzer for 2013. We published in early 2012. The second one was much more dangerous.
I know.
I was tipped off many years before that the children of some of the elite political families were making millions or tens of millions or billions of dollars holding so-called secret shares, I was told. They're like off the books, no one knew it. And this was told to me by many different people at dinner parties. And I wanted to figure out, is that true? Is there any way to know if it's true? How does that happen? How did they get the money? Who passes it off to them? So I spent a year looking at corporate records, working, actually Lynn and others worked with me to figure out, could we trace the money in China? I mean, it's hard to trace the money anywhere. So in China, in Chinese corporate records. And to my big surprise, I thought maybe I'll find $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. We found billions, right? We published $2.7 billion of family wealth for the family of the prime minister of China, the sitting prime minister at that time. We actually found closer to $5 billion. But to be very conservative, to be very cautious, we wanted to make sure if we went to court, could we prove it? Did we have the documents? So we tightened it up. We made sure, like, legally, accounting-wise, and we published in October 2012 a story that said the family of the sitting prime minister has $2.7 billion in the official records, and many of those investments are tied to things that the prime minister oversaw, like the financial services industry. So that was the more dangerous of the two articles. Both of them led to trouble. Apple was not happy with the New York Times.
Of course.
For a while, I think it canceled some of its advertisements. But certainly the Chinese government was very upset that we would publish a story like this in 2012. So that gave me, and Lin and the New York Times, we were blocked, as you probably know.
Yes.
The New York Times was blocked.
And then visa problem.
We were followed.
Yeah.
They didn't allow reporters from the New York Times in. So it was several years of challenges for us on the ground.
And I was recently told that even the bureau, the staff working in the bureau has been greatly reduced.
Yes.
Because now is a complete different era.
Right.
So I consider that you would say that during your era, it was really fortunate that you can actually report different stories.
So I would say, despite the fact that we were followed by the government all the time, I mean, from the beginning, we were relatively free. I could report on art, I can travel the country, I could go anywhere but Tibet, and felt pretty free, you know, followed once in a while, but not really impacting stories. And even after my series on the prime minister's family, I still spent three more years traveling in China, reporting from China, followed more, threatened sometimes, but still, through the time I left, up to the time I left, end of 2015, I had relative freedom. As you know, after I left, the government got more strict on journalists. During COVID, they kicked out the New York Times, most of the New York Times reporters, the Wall Street Journal. Now is very different. The era that I was in was the best, I would think, would consider it the best time to cover China, the most free time. I could meet all sorts of people. They didn't have surveillance everywhere. So you came up with tricks of how to, if you were followed, tinted windows, or you travel to a different city and then you take a car, lots of things that we did to try to get around the surveillance. That would be very difficult today for any journalist.
One thing I was very interested in, and let's talk about it, because during COVID time, we realized that China actually has been the global supply for many, many items. Mm. So you've been traveling all around China, seeing factories. I mean, there's many country outsourced to China. And you were saying that you've been visiting provinces where they make one product, like a sock city, t-shirt cities, and all that. Just you know, it is really surprising because it's only a few decades that China could be able to create such global supply center, which is, I mean, totally surprising. And you were witnessing all these happening.
Yeah, this is actually maybe my favorite thing about being a correspondent in China. So you think about in the 90s and early 2000s, China's starting low with textiles and t-shirts, you know, toys and things. But in the time I'm there, they're going to go from the very low all the way up now to EV batteries, etc. And so if you traveled around China while I was there in the 2000s, you could go to provinces and you could see the lowest level factories, you could see, you know, food factories, plastic factories, all sorts of, like, you know, dangerous factories. I've been in aquaculture seafood factories, etc., all the way up to the highest quality goods, right? Luxury brands or electronics or cars.
But China only really started manufacturing is like in 1980s.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Mao passed away.
Right.
So with the machineries by 2000, they must have really high mm-hmm. technology machineries there.
Mm-hmm. You know, even when I got there, there was still, and maybe there is still today, talk about China is really low quality, low cost. But during the time I was there and you were there, it changed dramatically, right? So think about the 80s and the early 90s. They are kind of a brilliant strategy, which is we will invite all global manufacturers, starting with the low ones. Here is free land or subsidized land. We will let you bring in equipment, right? We will bring workers to you. And when I got to China, even 2004, I remember visiting a factory and I said, what do you get paid in this factory to a worker? And they said 500 RMB a month. And I thought, wow, not even like that's like $80,
$70 in US dollars is?
Yeah, $70 or $80 a month. And I didn't realize at the time they were including their overtime. So this isn't 40 hours a week, normal. Then they were working lots of overtime. So they could have been making something like
200.
10 to 15 cents, 20 cents an hour to do this. So you think of moving that job from Europe, from the U.S., all of a sudden, every global company said, we could get cheap land, workers that are not unionized, that will pay 15 cents an hour. They were willing to work 7 days a week. And I think you may know also, Pearl, that when they set up these factories, they were factory cities. So you would have your factory, right? And then the dorm was built on the factory grounds. So the workers would move from Sichuan or another province, live in the dorms for 3 or 4 years, 8 to a room. They could only go from their room to the canteen to the factory floor. They could be called at 2 a.m., more production. So it was almost like the perfect system to lower the costs for those producers. So just think of like 90s, 2000s. Every year, they're getting a little better. The quality is getting a little higher. More higher value companies come in and say, well, if they can do it, we can do it. You get Nike. I've been to the Nike factory. Amazing. You get Apple. You get Dell. You get Microsoft. So pretty soon, it's really about who doesn't come to China. You're going to lose out, right?
Yeah.
The economies of scale. So I was telling you that I went to Sock City.
Yeah.
Bra City. T-shirt City. You know, they had all these specialty cities. Penn City. There was a city that made most of the world's pens.
Wow.
And actually, I remember going in and there was a person who was screwing together like they didn't have a machine. Someone would get the two parts and screw together every one all day long. So many people that did that, obviously.
And I was told at the time there were a lot of buying offers in Hong Kong.
Yes.
And they all go through Hong Kong and then they all started to...
Yes.
...to go, especially with garments.
Right.
But then during the COVID time, we realized that China is actually the medicine cabinet.
That's right.
I mean, who would believe this? And at the time, did you visit that?
Yeah. Actually, even before COVID, I knew that lots of pharmaceuticals were being made. There was in 2000, maybe 7 or 8, a scandal in the U.S. with something called heparin, which is this drug. And they had some like contamination. It was injuring people in the U.S. And we actually went and visited some of the heparin factories in China. I remember going to one, I think, in Jiangsu, which was a home factory. They were making this very expensive drug in the homes of workers. Whoa. And you could walk in. And by the way, heparin was made partly by pig intestines.
Something
as one of the raw materials. Yeah. So you could see there's a slaughterhouse nearby, or there's a, you know, they're getting all of the pig intestines from that area and bringing them to the homes. Think of people working in their homes for global pharmaceutical companies.
Not that they
didn't have other big factories, but there were even home factories in some cases for common drugs or very important drugs. So China and India, I think, are still making most of the world drugs.
At home.
Yeah. And well, not at home, but some at home. And there, again, there are the levels of the factories. And what was a challenge when I was there is sometimes the factory would show you the factory and say it's made here, but they would outsource some of it to a cheaper factory. And they would outsource some of it to people at home to keep lowering the cost. So you might not know. You think your stuff is made in the Nike factory. Is it actually made in the outsourced factory?
So having said that, we're talking about medicine, drugs.
Mm-hmm.
How does people know, or how do anybody knows that the quality is there? I mean...
Yeah. It's the FDA is supposed to regulate and visit those FDA-approved factories. But the challenge in China, not just for drugs, but for any product, is there can always be the factory behind the factory. And your inspectors, whether you're Mattel, I visited Mattel's factory, I visited Nike's factory, I visited Apple's factory, and others, there can always be the hidden factories. And there can be bribes paid to the inspectors, or they don't actually, they go to the fake factory, that the show factory, when it's not really coming from there. So to have a full system, I think it got better, by the way. I don't want to mislead that.
Because
over time, the factories I visited, the quality, the standards, the things that I saw seemed to be improving pretty dramatically. But you always had the issue of whether you could really fully inspect the factory.
Wow.
Yeah. So actually, I think, Pearl, I should have taken you to some of these factories because
I would
think
love to see it.
The great thing for people outside of China to see is, where are the things you're using made? How are they made? What are the raw materials?
Because some of these medicine goes throughout the, it's global.
Yes. So that became one of my favorite things, is to see where are things produced, how are they produced, who funds it, what are the raw materials that go into it.
How interesting. So I remember when I was reading some notes, there was one topic that you were talking about, is about food and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Are these related to what we are discussing about the food and drugs? And does China actually has a food and drug regulation?
They do, and they've had many problems over the years. So when I was there, they executed the head of the Food and Drug Administration. I wrote about that. So they, like, it was so bad with tainted drugs, with children dying from tainted drugs. So they executed the head of the FDA. And they had lots of different food and drug scandals. Maybe we didn't even hear about half of them. So they had serious problems. We haven't heard as many. I'm not so sure that means they went away or it's not widely reported. But they have, over time, had lots of food and drug and toy safety and other things. But I think that's also kind of like when you're scaling up a country and you're building everything overnight and you're doing lots of new things.
Yeah, because you have to catch up.
Yes.
Everything is fast, fast, fast. I think same thing happens in America as well.
Right, right.
I mean, America, the food industry is horrible because they want everything fastly grown.
Right, right. And if you don't have free press and you don't have good regulation and good inspection of those factories, it's going to be hard to control that.
Let's talk about environment.
Mm-hmm.
You did a series about environment.
Yes.
Can you just give us an overview?
Yes. So we did a series, I think it was 2007 or 8, looking at the environment. And you can imagine China's impact. If every manufacturer is moving their production, which means they're moving their raw materials, which means they're pumping all that gas and mm-hmm. oil and all that stuff, is rather than happening in the US, in Germany, in Japan, you're moving it all to China, and they're using coal to fire those plants and other things and their electricity, you're going to have some serious environmental problems. Also, China at the beginning was, we welcome foreign investment. Don't worry about the environmental restrictions. We don't have those. So literally, some of the owners said to me, or businessmen said to me, we were told just dump it in the rivers, like in the early days, like we're not going to inspect that. Now, they, of course, over time, they got more and more concerned, but China became heavily, heavily polluted because they're using dirty fuel. They are producing not just China's goods, but the world's goods. And they don't have environmental standards, right, for a long time. So you can imagine the waterways. You can imagine even the farmlands that were polluted.
Hold on first, because I remember I used to see Beijing was very dark and gray and everything. Mm-hmm. But recently, mm-hmm. Beijing is crispy blue sky.
Yeah.
I mean, it's beautiful. This is before COVID time.
Yeah.
And I remember I arrived in Beijing and I said, wow, what a beautiful sky. And the driver was telling me, do you know how many people could not afford the electricity? They're all frozen to death in order to have the blue sky.
Right, right.
Was that true?
I don't know. I haven't been there for that change, but I do know that post-Olympics, they slowly started to force the factories around Beijing, even far away, because it's all blowing in. So I think Beijing made a major effort to move steel factories or coal-fired, like all of that stuff out of Beijing, especially around the political and cultural center of China.
One of the argument that China uses, and I do believe is quite fair, mm-hmm. because if you remember, they're talking about Industrial Revolution, like in UK, mm-hmm. during the time the sky was all black, you go through that in order to build up a country, to build up and evolve into a developed country.
Right.
And of course, China, or any developing countries, they won't have that chance to do that. And they don't want to be limited by environment.
Right.
But at the same time, and China wants to lead the Paris Climate Committee. So the contradiction is
I think it's more of a, if you put it on the timeline. So first they make the bet and say, right now we want food, right? We want jobs. So we're willing to be dirty for a while, and we want to move up the value chain and we'll get better. And that was from the 90s all the way through the time I was there. And it was probably really after the Olympics, maybe even around the time of the Olympics, they got really serious, because I was there for the Olympics, the opening ceremonies, like clean the skies, like this is an embarrassment. So I think after 2008, they got more and more serious. They got serious about solar and wind and just renewables. And they also know they don't have the resources. And the country is going to be polluted. So I think it's not a contradiction. It's more them sensing over time we are gradually shifting to green. But if you said to them today, do you want to go green in cause the loss of lots of jobs, they might still say, okay, we don't want to be that green, right?
Exactly.
But we want to, also green is an opportunity for China, right? It's like we could lead with electric vehicles and other things.
China manufactures so many EVs.
Yeah, we should think of them as China as almost like 10 countries. Yeah. They are both green and dirty and old sort of factories and new factories and middle factories. When I would travel around China, I would often say to myself, okay, this city, I'm going back to the 1970s. This city, I'm back in the 1940s. Wow, this city looks like 1920. Or this city looks like 2030. So you can see everything in China.
But isn't that USA is also a very polluted country?
It is. It is.
Country. So if you have a developed economy who also produce so much pollution,
yes,
what makes the world is going against China? Something, you know, that I don't understand.
Well,
it seems to be so much double standard.
Yeah. I think more of it is, if you think about our time there, even in Shanghai, you know, we were there together, and from 2004 to the time I left, almost 2016, even though Shanghai is a beautiful city, if you said, how many days did you see sun in blue skies in Shanghai every month? I might say 2 days, right? I mean, it's not like Beijing, but everywhere I went in China, I saw, except like Yunnan and out west, I saw polluted city after polluted city after polluted city. I don't think the U.S. is even close to that. Part of the reason, though, when you think about the contradiction, is the U.S. moved a lot of its production of dirtier things to China.
Another very interesting topic that we were talking about, since we're talking about covering everything, is technology,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, China technology giants like Alibaba, Tencent, mm-hmm, JD.com, you met them all and they became really successful. Mm-hmm. And all of them went public in NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. And actually, they are American companies rather than Chinese companies.
Mm.
Then you have all these American companies trying to, like Google's Facebook. Facebook is not even in China. Mm. They all go into China, but they fail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why?
I think it was a combination of reasons. First, it is very difficult for not just technology companies, but any company from outside to adapt to China. So you would think in any country, the locals will know the taste better, will know the culture, will know how to serve right. And I think the companies from the West or from the globe that went into China, they went in and they did things that China cannot quickly catch up with, right? China cannot, in a couple of years, figure out luxury goods and all of a sudden serve up better things than the best brands or even high technology. But every year they're going to get better and better. And as they get better, the people, the entrepreneurs on the ground, like Jack Ma or, mm-hmm, or Pony Ma, they are going to figure out, well, what do we learn from Google or Yahoo or the others? And how do I adapt that to China's tastes and to what people want? It won't be exactly, you can't just take your idea from the US and say, well, Chinese are exactly the same. They will like it. They will like it to look the same. They'll like the same colors. So I think the brands, whether technology or not, that did well in China, either they had a huge advantage that China just desperately needed, or they adapted and made themselves more like China. And I think for the Western tech companies, they were there. So they had several problems. One is, how do you adapt and compete with the locals? Secondly is, the Chinese government doesn't really want to have some of these tech companies to have that influence in China. So they're stricter, right?
Apple,
right. Apple, they were okay.
Apple is retail, right?
Yeah, it's a hard product. It's not, and they can control Apple still, right? So they were really interested in influence. At that time, does Apple have news? They're selling at the beginning Macs and iPhones, and it wasn't about news.
How about Microsoft? Most of the operating system,
yep,
in the Chinese,
yep,
government,
yes,
is a Microsoft operating,
yes,
system.
But remember, Microsoft for a long time, including maybe up to today, did not do well in China despite everyone adopting their software. So they were getting it for free. They were buying pirated versions. And I think for a long time, Microsoft was okay with that, saying, we want you almost like free at the beginning and get used to it, get addicted to it, use it with the government, and eventually you'll pay. And I think Microsoft has had some success, but in many ways, they never really, you know, Apple is the most successful, I would say, right? They had a product that at the beginning you couldn't just easily copy.
Yeah.
And so I think when I went to China, a American brand, if it had $1 billion in revenue in China to consumers, that was big. Apple, by the time I left, might have had $70 billion in revenue in mainland China, something like 50,
which
70.
Which is unheard of for a foreign company.
Yes, yes. So they were, I'm pretty sure that is the most successful brand ever in the China market. And it's one the government didn't stop from producing, and it didn't force it into a joint venture.
But that was hardware, but they also produce in China. It helps in employment.
That's right. They're maybe the largest employer
of
all the global brands in China.
And I think Tesla is doing very well as well. Yes,
that's right. That's right.
Is it because of the government relationship?
I think that helps because those are partnerships. I would say the government, it's not that the government helps make a better brand or a better company. It's more that the government allows you to thrive or not to thrive.
So you are saying that Facebook, Google is all those technology which is sharing information and messages, and they don't want this transparency.
That's right. That's right. But I would say the two things, right, is one, can Facebook compete with WeChat and Tencent in the Chinese brands? That's challenging. Yeah. And then the other part is the government won't allow them to compete. So with those two factors, very difficult for any company that's related to influence or media or social things to thrive as a foreign brand in China.
But this also includes luxury brand. That some of the luxury brand, I think many luxury brand, they want to go into China because of the consumer power.
Yep.
They all want to have, a bit of China.
Yeah.
They want the market, they want the consumption, but not many is successful.
I wonder, Pearl. I don't know the numbers now, but when I think about my time there with you in Shanghai, the luxury brands, first of all, they were all setting up shops in Shanghai and in Beijing and other places, not crowded because the tax on them, the cost was so high, people went to Hong Kong, right, to buy them. And then they'd bring them back, or they went to Tokyo or Japan. So they would bring the luxury, or the U.S. to bring it back. They would pay for their trip, the savings in the taxes and the VAT and everything. But I think the brands overall, I think the brands would tell you, we look at China as a global number and not what it sells just in China. We know this is a Chinese customer buying in Fifth Avenue in New York or in Tokyo or in Hong Kong. And the luxury brands, very hard for Chinese brands to compete with them at the top level.
Is it because of the marketing budget?
They have marketing. They have amazing marketing.
Because I look at like a big brand like Erdu. Erdu is a big enough brand.
Yep, yep.
And then they have French. You know, they got a French designer. Yep. What is his name? Who used to be Karl Lagerfeld and works in Chanel. They were doing the whole things. They spend money on advertising. Mm-hmm. But it's only remaining local.
Yeah.
They don't go overseas. Mm-hmm. It's just that they don't have the confidence to go overseas to take the market out.
You know, I hope this doesn't sound strange, but I think in my time in China, it is the first period or at the beginning of the period where Chinese are able to afford luxury brands and Starbucks. And so it is a status symbol too to show I have made it. So when I went, I was like, wow, the Starbucks is so much more crowded and better run than the one in the U.S. because it is like a luxury brand. Everyone wants to be seen there. And the luxury brands, if you can get to that level, it like changes your status in society. So this is, you know, people would say the luxury brands actually would change, and they would say, make the logos bigger because the Chinese love the bigger logos. They want to show where it's from. So I think that is the period maybe we're still in. China is huge. So I think the luxury brands have been among the most successful because China can't ease. I mean, they can have knockoffs, which they do, but still people want the real thing. They want the quality. And so if I were to look through the books and say, what are the areas of business where foreign brands succeeded really well in China, I would say auto for a while. I would say Apple and some technology. I would say luxury brands, like really the high quality. Yes, the stuff that you cannot.
Hermes, Chanel, Dior.
Yes. I mean, even in New York, I would come back from China to visit New York, and there were Chinese everywhere in New York buying the luxury brands here. So that is probably one of the biggest success stories. And someone might even say, pumped up the value of those luxury brands because China was the new market.
Absolutely.
It is minting, as you know from your time in Shanghai, you're still there in Shanghai. Everyone wanted to go to Shanghai. Everyone wanted to meet the new rich. Who were the new rich Chinese? What were they buying? The art world, which you're in, right? They started buying art.
Yes, absolutely. Another question I think is very interesting is, with this U.S.-China conflict, what you read on the Western media is, before, everything about China is great. Today, everything about China is bad. It's like bashing China. Is there any more objectivities in media?
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that I constantly question.
Yeah.
Where is the objectivities in any journalism?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like newspaper media is falling in government policy. So I want to know your thoughts about that.
Yeah. This is a really tough topic for me because I think all the time about how is China portrayed, how is the U.S.-China relationship portrayed. We're in a polarizing period.
Absolutely.
Right? Not just China, but the
world. The whole world.
So I actually think in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, it has become so polarized and so fueled by also what's on social media that there's been a tendency to go to the extremes to attract more attention. Not just the news media, but just everyone wants to go and blare theirs. And so that sort of very complex mix of political currents around the world, also what's happened between the leaders of the U.S. and China, very different from when I met you in China, right? It was engagement, the era of engagement, the era of everyone wanted to see China, the new China, the integration with the world. Chinese students come to the U.S., U.S. students
Absolutely.
Go to China. Now, all of a sudden, because of, I would say, many complex factors.
Every single newspaper or every single story about China is negative. I mean, you cannot be to one extreme to another extreme.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very sad
yeah.
because, you know, when I see it, I say, oh, my God, you know, this is not journalism. Journalism should be objective. Why today? I cannot find any objectivities in all the major press.
Yes. And so it's, I hate to say this, but tonight I had dinner and the woman sitting next to me, who's a lawyer, she was telling me about how she feels that, not about the U.S. and China, but about the U.S., the coverage in the U.S. Everything is negative. And then you say, and the U.S.-China coverage. So the amount of negative coverage, and I don't know if anyone has done a study, but it would be interesting to see in the last 5 to 7 years.
So how can you enhance that understanding between the West and the East?
Yeah. I wish I had an answer, but I do, you know, I have the magazine.
Yes.
That we run, The Wire China, and I think about every issue about, can we be more fair, more open-minded, get as many, there are no like taboo ideas. We would interview Republicans who are hardliners or Chinese. If Chinese government said, we would love to interview them and say what you will say, but say it with the freedom, the forum, the discussion, the debate, we'll ask tough questions, but we don't want to be an opinion magazine. We want to be a fair balance.
Absolutely. That's what journalism should be.
Yeah.
Should be. So, okay. So now, after all the years in China, after doing, and now you're ongoing doing The Wire, you know, publishing The Wire China. Do you believe that there is a huge misunderstanding between the West and the East, West and China, especially US and China? And what can be done?
Yeah.
I mean, we always say the culture is soft power. We should use the culture to be the way of communicating.
Right.
And I was hoping that US, you know, two big economies, these two big economies is very essential that they can work together because the world needs to work to work together.
Yeah.
And with now, you know, China is forming another alliance with the other cities. It's just like, it's getting more and more complicated.
Yeah. I kind of, well, how about if I put it in this way? I hope the two governments do their parts to figure out a way to be less hostile, right? They have to do part. But then there's the part that we can do, citizens, journalists, or others, to say, how do you not fall into the trap of one extreme or the other, or thinking the other side is the devil or evil, right? We know China is not evil. So you write about the people, you get different viewpoints, you don't pick up the same language of hate or stereotyping.
Most of the media is insinuating China is evil. Look at the Hollywood movie. I mean, who you know, is always the baddies now is either Russians or Chinese.
I don't see many Chinese as the bad. I see Russians sometimes.
Russians, definitely.
I wonder if they're starting to do, because, you know, for a while, they actually used to say that China invested a lot in Hollywood and they wouldn't have them as the baddies because they need to get into the China film market.
Oh, yeah,
it's changed a little.
Because there were a lot of investment from Alibaba, Tencent, and all that.
Right.
But today, would the Chinese government allow that investment, or would America allow these movies to be accepted by the Chinese money as well?
Yes.
I mean, this is
I mean,
America already now has stopped the US funds investing in and in China.
Yeah.
And then next thing, we have the FT big topic saying that, oh, you know, China now is the, has the lowest foreign investment. I mean, all this is negative news.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon.
No.
But if the two governments have to take the lead, I don't think it's going to come outside of the government that strong. If the two governments both decide, like, turn up the dial, and the people around the governments, because there's Congress, there's others, right?
But your Congress is very united against China. From what I've read.
I wonder, I don't know for sure, but I don't notice the Democrats as hawkish as the Republicans. And by the way, our magazine is soon going to interview Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, very interesting.
And I want them to ask her, how do the Democrats see China, because you don't hear a lot of rhetoric about China from, at least as far as I know so far, is Why is it that the Republicans are much more upfront and out front on the China issue and the Democrats are not? I don't know the answer. It's not that Biden is soft. He's a Democrat, is soft on China because he's been tough. But the rhetoric,
he's very tough, actually.
But the rhetoric that they use is very different for the Republicans and the Democrats. And maybe they're united in a way, but they're not as vocal for some reason. Maybe it's because Biden is in office, or I don't know. But I think now if you go to Washington, you hear most of the rhetoric is led by the group of Republicans, and they are very hawkish, and the Democrats are kind of quiet. Like, I don't hear Schumer say much on China. I think Schumer visited China this year. He used to complain that China, like, manipulated his currency. I don't hear him complain as much, so I think they're fairly united, but maybe it's not as equal as you think.
I don't know. I agree with you. I don't think in the near future that these two relationships will be resolved. Mm. But all we can hope is it's less harsh with each other.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Pearl, because when I was there in China in 2013 or 14, Vice President Biden visited. Was in Beijing. I was in Beijing. And he met with a group of us journalists.
Oh, I remember that time because yeah. They were supposed to revoke all your visa.
Yes.
And then
yes.
He was there.
He was
and
there.
And then he savaged all yes. your working visas.
He
yeah.
met Xi Jinping before. I think he had just come from meeting Xi Jinping. And we had an off-the-record session, but we talked about the visa situation. But also Vice President Biden said, like, he has had this relationship with Vice President Xi. They traveled in China. I think they went to Chengdu together. They went and had, you know, different things to eat. And they had the closest relationship of a Chinese and American sitting official in history. And that this would actually, once she became president, which we knew, we didn't know Biden would become president, but they knew she would become president, that this would be better, right? That they would have this great. And so when Biden became president, they said, well, he's met Xi, I don't know, 50 times, and they have this long relationship. So this is one chance that maybe those bonds they developed long ago would pay off. And in fact, the relationship is the worst it's been probably since Mao.
Yeah.
Right? So that's hard to explain. I think it was set in motion long before, it's hard to unwind.
Yeah, I thought that was, I mean, I don't know America. I mean, I'm guessing through that. That must be the direction your Congress is looking at. Mm. Because, you know, in China, or even in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. Well, many would say that America is building all obstacles to stop China to rise.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Since this podcast is about China's rise and influence, we might as well discuss this. Mm. So the China is saying that America would not allow China to rise. So they set up all the blocks because mm-hmm. America, ambition, is always to remain to be the world leader.
Mm.
What is your thoughts about that?
I don't think I can answer that. I'm not enough of a political science or international mm-hmm. relations person to know. But it makes sense that China would say that. When they blocked Huawei, you don't want Huawei. But I think there's a lot of complicating factors.
Of course, there
right?
are effects that, and that we won't know. But in general, everywhere is talking about, you know, China supposedly would take over America. Like yeah. every 100 years, there's another country yeah. taking over.
I think, though, when I think about what, you know, we're doing this series in The Wire China on U.S.-China relations. And we would love to have more Chinese, but we can't get them. And so there were a lot of former U.S. officials talking about the relationship. So there were also on the U.S. side the perceptions of the cyber attacks. I don't know if you saw it just
this
week.
Yes, I just read.
They
said
China is embedding itself in the infrastructure to be able to turn it off. They're aligning with Russia.
They were using a lot of private. Yeah.
They're the surveillance state, and they're even putting that surveillance overseas. I think it's not. I think it would be too simplistic to see it as the number two, one is afraid of the number two, although I don't discount that there is some of that. You just think of also American companies have challengers.
Of course.
But if you think of our time in China, I think, you know, there was, because the Chinese government and the U.S. government had a much better relationship. When she came into office, the relationship changed dramatically. I don't blame it all on him, but many people do. And then Trump came into office and really changed the relationship.
I think Trump started it.
I think both of those leaders contributed a lot of different things that made the other side, gave the other side reason to believe that, oh, okay, they are using their technology to challenge us. We're going to use our technology to challenge them. Their military is doing this. Our military is doing this. So I actually, maybe this is just me being an old-fashioned journalist, but I would say there's a lot of blame to go around on both sides. And I think figuring out that it's one or the other to me is probably not right. It's probably the combination of I don't say the U.S. didn't make a lot of mistakes, because they did, and China did too. And I think no one will ever get to the bottom of it is it's your fault. It's more, how do we get along? How do we go ahead? How do we're integrated already. Like, if we get, you know, when I take my COVID tests, I look at the packages. All of the packages are made in China. There are no American-made COVID tests, right? So I need China's COVID tests, right? So I use equipment, things that are made in China. My wife is born in China,
yeah.
Right? So there is the integration, and there will, I don't think in 30 years, 40 years, they're not going to separate. So it's really about how well do they integrate, and to do the two governments stop seeing each other in such a hostile way and blaming the other side, but find a path that they work together, or at least decide, how do we coexist? Because you're not going away, I'm not going away. We're the two largest economies.
Two egos.
We should do things together.
It's like egos fighting with each other.
Yeah.
And then with Mr. Trump being the president, I think the situation would turn even worse.
Yeah.
Because egos and egos and egos.
Yeah. Everyone knows about the Pearl Lamb dinners, right?
Yes.
There were these dinners, and there was this long table, and there were guests from around the world that were coming together. And I guess we thought during that period, wow, this is a place where you'll meet interesting people. I remember sitting next to Bill Gates' mother-in-law at one of the dinners.
He's not mother-in-law, but stepmother.
Stepmother.
Mimi.
And just so Mimi many Gates. Interesting people from the art world, but also from the business world, from politics, etc. And that was sort of, for us, the bridge-building period. Right, where you're just learning, and there's a sense of the international world is arriving in China, and there is this bridge. You were that bridge. Since then, I don't know if you still have those dinners, but I get a sense that there are fewer foreign travelers.
There are fewer visitors.
I see fewer Chinese visit the U.S. I see some university students or faculty feel less safe in the U.S. because there's anti-China.
Yeah.
What do you think can be done to build bridges or to repair the bridges that you helped build for U.S.-China relations?
I always like to create something like a salon. So I always have a dinner table because I'm a foodie, as you all know. So I always believe that, you know, sharing foods, sharing drinks, but put people from all different areas together, whether it is culture, business, finance, or sometimes I even have writers, drag queens, queens together, because, is you know, what we are looking at is a contemporary culture, an international contemporary culture. And I always believe that, you know, when you... Culture is soft power and is a language that is not intimidative. It's not about power, you know, it's not about, you know, competing or fighting for power. So that was really nice things that you start to understand each other because you're creating. And truly enough, now China has much less foreigners, international people visiting. And I think one of the things is, initially, it was very hard to get visa, the tourist visa. But now the tourist visa is really relaxed. I mean, I have friends applying for one trip. He was given 2 years, multiple. So I think China is welcoming having people back.
I think one of those things that you did and that we can still do is humanize the China story. In other words, China is not the letters China or the Communist Party, right?
No.
There are Chinese artists, writers, documentary filmmakers, all of the people that you know, have met, have interviewed, visit their studios, to see those people and hear their stories. Like when I meet people, like I think about my experience in China, like one of the most beautiful things was not interviewing the business elites, but actually visiting the countryside, visiting the factories, or meeting the migrant workers who came to the cities and hearing their stories, right? What they went through, how they survived or made it somewhere. And I think also I hope, will listen to stories that humanize the foreigners, the Westerners, and not stereotype them. Or I have this, like when we were talking, I was thinking, there's this fear, and very easy to just like stereotype it and act as if it's China that's doing everything, right? It's government policies that you may not like. It's a part of, this is something you don't like, but if it becomes something about China or Asians, that is very bad and dangerous, and we should call it out, right? And we should want the stories of ordinary Chinese or talented Chinese or Chinese fashion, the people in the fashion world that you know, or, like I said, the writers, the filmmakers, and also bringing those intellectuals and others. And I'm hoping that China will be open to them having the freedom they had when I was there. As you know, when we were together in Shanghai, we could say anything. It wasn't
taboo. I think now is a little bit more difficult, because even exhibitions, if you have a foreign artist you coming to China having an exhibition, we need exhibition license.
Yeah.
If you have a catalog, Chinese artist catalog printed abroad, you need license.
Yeah.
I think, you know, at that point, China themselves is also in fear that all these cultural events may create unrest. The same thing, I think the West is seeing China being intimidating.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the both sides
are
having such fear.
Yeah.
So it's not, you cannot advance one step and being close one, because there must be a sense of trust.
Right. Yeah, I almost want to say it will be easier for me to humanize the China experience here than for you to humanize or to build bridges in China if the state says no.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping it could be a cycle.
You know, I'm hoping that there are now a lot of government officials and a lot of younger generation who's been educated abroad. Hopefully, when they have been abroad, they actually appreciate or understand the Western way of thinking and the culture, then they would understand the West much better. Then it will bring the upper power to, you know, at least to tell them, not having this misunderstanding. That's the only way to go
through. I also think the people like yourself or others coming from China or Hong Kong or even Taiwan and other places, meeting the, not just Americans, but meeting the different stakeholders and saying, not just saying you're wrong, but talking to them about why do you believe that, and let me show you this side and let you consider this. That's part of the education process. You want policymakers, you want academics. I know, you know, I've been to many conferences recently of a lot of leading China experts, scholars, policymakers. I can tell you at the conferences I've been to, it's been high level and very impressive discussions. It is not like China hate or anti-China conferences. There are a lot of smart people out there thinking about how do we resolve these things? How do we build bridges? How do we think about the challenges? It is a very complex problem with two very strong governments locked in. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out how to make it so that it's not dangerous, right? You don't want...
It's about the willingness. The willingness to be united, the willingness to understand each other. It's like a marriage.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right? You have to be open. But I think the sphere is too much.
Right.
And I really believe that they really don't understand each other.
And it's hard to accept, because if you call it a marriage, this marriage has been going on for a long time and it got pretty solid, and then it hit a surprising bump on both sides, like unpredictable.
So it's a prevention.
Yes. Yes.
No one would believe that Mr. Trump would become a president, and no one would believe that Mr. Trump would become completely so right.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Supported by Tea Party. So
yeah.
So we never know what the next one will be, the next minute, the next second.
Who knows? Maybe in 2 years we're sitting back at these mics and actually things have changed. I hope things have changed dramatically, because we could have never predicted this. Yeah.
So let me ask you a final question. Okay. How do you see the why China in the next, your next stage?
I see it as... you know, I would like the Wired China to be the publication on China's interaction with the world. We're not in China. We're not writers inside China, but outside. And I would like it to be considered like hard-hitting journalism, but also balanced journalism, thoughtful, educational journalism, and not with an agenda or not with a sense that we tell you what to think, but we give you ideas. And by the way, I don't know if you know, but we have the China Books Review with Asia Society.
I just read. So we just started 2 or 3.
It's also culture, like building bridges and saying, it's not just China business that we're going to tell you about or China politics, but also China culture. Writers, artists, photography, like lots of different things. I think if those two things work together, that's one side of our business. The other side of our business is Wirescreen, which is the data. And we want to be a great global data analytics firm. And so if we could be a great company that transforms the space of understanding how companies go global, and we could produce, starting with China, but maybe even broadening to other parts of Asia, and say, we're going to teach you and educate you and give you that bridge to the rest of the world. Asia is just a gigantic part of the world. How can you not understand it? So you should think about their books, their culture, their history, their businesses. They're your competitors and they're your suppliers. So you need to understand that.
Thank you, David, for joining me. We had such a great time. And I learned so much from you. You again and again and again.
Pearl, it's been a delight. It's like old times in Shanghai. Thanks for inviting me.